You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Yeah, my name's Terry Guy from Secret Walls. You're listening to Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio. What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels who are shaping our culture. I'm your host, Josh Levine. This week, I'm sitting with Terry Guy. He's the founder of Secret Walls. I love this company and this brand and everything they're doing. If you don't know, Secret Walls is a series of graffiti battles happening all over the world. They have them online. They have them popping up in the metaverse soon, if not already. And it's just a really cool story of you know, this brand that's built on culture. And I love the way he talks about putting the culture first and the community and using that to build a great company. Some great lessons. I think you're going to enjoy this one. Let's get into it right now with Terry Guy.
I'm excited to dig in and, yeah, and see how you got to this point. So I always like to start at the very beginning, and I think for a lot of us, music defines our lives. Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
First record is probably a record, MC Hammer.
Piece of music.
yeah, a vinyl. I didn't really have vinyl, but okay. MC Hammer, nice. Randomly, because he was wearing those big baggy pants. And I saw a few tracks that caught my imagination.
And that's in London?
Yeah, no, actually, I'm from the Isle of Wight, which, okay. So going right back from a little place called the Isle of Wight, which is like a Victorian beach island in the very south, known really for famous music festivals like the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix. I think it was Hendrix's last ever gig before he passed in London, but they used to do 100,000 plus like festivals down there. So I came from there, grew up there, no graffiti, no street art. Kind of scraped my way through college, learning computer programming and bits. Just about got enough to get to university that then got me to London, and that was the kind of ticket to here's the real world.
Sure.
So yeah, I kind of jumped in the deep end, didn't know anybody in London, and got exposed to graffiti. I was into hip hop already. Mm-hmm. So talking about music, I was you know, I bought a lot of Biggie, Tupac, and I was into all the East Coast, West Coast stuff.
Yep.
And then I went to a B-boy event. Again, never been before, but it was kind of like this B-boy battle weekly dance-off thing. And I was like, this is awesome. And I saw graffiti on the walls, and I was 18 at the time. And that kind of just, it blew my mind. And kind of that really seeded Secret Walls. Like, it was another 2 years before Secret Walls was a thing.
Yeah.
But I started networking in those circles and started to like see a path, you know? So
where does that shift happen if you're studying computer programming and you've got your sort of like passion on the side?
Yeah.
Do you remember it? Those worlds coming together and deciding, yeah, okay, this is going to be my path?
So I was studying digital animation and computer design for my degree.
Okay.
So it kind of moved from coding to website design and animation and Maya and all these like old softwares that maybe don't even exist anymore. I thought in my head I was going to be an animator for like Disney or something. I thought that was the dream. Okay. But quite quickly, year and a half into the course, I realized I was probably one of the worst in my class and I was going to just about coast through again, which was kind of the story up to that point.
Sure.
Wasn't very good at education. And I was always focused on, you know, what the shortcut might be or the hustle or the passion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I went to that B-boy event and started mixing graffiti artists and seeing kind of talent on a wall that was only selling for like $30 at the time. It's like canvases this big for like 50 yeah. bucks. So I was just like, this is crazy. Like, what's going on? Realized galleries weren't giving street artists a chance. Banksy hadn't started really then. Banksy wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. I went to a Banksy show around that time and he was selling work for like £100 a print. Which I regret not buying.
Hopefully you bought a bunch of them.
I didn't, yeah, but I wish I did. But I read a story that some students spent thousands of pounds of their student loan on multiple prints and basically ended up with a few hundred thousand a few years later. But it was a tough time for those kinds of artists. And I just started to hear a regular narrative and we kind of formed this thing called Monorex, which is still a business today, but mm-hmm. it was the original collective. And that was me being the kind of website designer slash manager of a crew of graffiti artists that we felt we could build something around. We didn't really know what. And it started as a party, live art party. Mm-hmm. We thought that was going to be a way to market ourselves. Filled a room, had some crazy canvas live art, like DJ experiences. And then I just needed to like figure out how do you then elevate that? And that's kind of where sequels came from. It was like, how do we create something that people care more, you know, more for, and the narrative is extended. And I'm a big soccer guy or football guy. I recently saw Fight Club and the Warriors, and there was a lot of competition and battles and things in my head, and the B-boy battles and the rap battles. And I just thought, well, why don't we just do an art battle? We weren't the first, obviously. Sure. You know, there was graffiti battles way before us, but that was all part of the inspiration. So Secret Walls was born from that. I suppose, yeah, it just snowballed from there.
It's time to reboot your credit card with Apple Card. Apple Card gives you up to 3% unlimited daily cash back. It's real cash you can spend right away. No need to wait and wait for rewards. Apply now in the Wallet app on iPhone to see your credit limit offer with no impact to your credit score. Subject to credit approval, daily cash is available via an Apple Cash Card or as a statement credit. See Apple Card Customer Agreement for terms and conditions. Apple Cash Card is issued by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Accepting an Apple Card after your application is approved will result in a hard inquiry, which may impact your credit score.
So going back to that first night, or was there a moment when you realized we've got something?
That was the first battle.
Yeah.
So I just naively booked a bar in Shoreditch, which is now kind of like the Williamsburg of London. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was kind of drug dealers and, you know, hookers and just crazy shit on the streets. But we booked a cheap bar. 500 people turned up, queue around the corner, something clicked, and it was before social media. So it was like just as MySpace was kicking off. We used MySpace, but really it was the physical flyer drops that we were doing and word of mouth. And
sure. We
somehow struck gold first night, and there was just an appetite. You could feel the electricity in the air. And everybody was like, is this a tournament? I'm like, no, it was a one-off event. But yeah, it can be. And then all of a sudden, 16 artists were signed up. And I built a kind of monthly knockout series that spanned like 6 months. And then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. We had to keep scaling the venue. Still weren't really making any money. It was kind of like, take a little bit off the bar, you know, when the bar hits a certain number, get some of the door. But it kind of covered itself. And I was working 3 part-time jobs and kind of still studying. But yeah, it was kind of, it wasn't a company, it wasn't a business, it was really, it was a lifestyle.
Sure.
I suppose the short answer is Reebok called us up maybe near the end of that tournament and were like, can you come to Barcelona and set up this battle inside a Reebok kind of booth that was huge. And they were just at the time doing a Pharrell Williams shoe drop, the ice cream drop. And they were like, we need something to pull a crowd to kind of, you know, rally around this ice cream shoe release. And we want you to battle every day for 5 days. And we were like, okay. We're like £30,000. So we just made up a number, you know, plus flights and Airbnb, and flew a squad of 15 of us out there, hosted this Reebok tournament. And yeah, we had stars turn up, and Pharrell and Thierry Henry, the soccer star. And it was kind of from that point, it was like, shit, this is a business. And there's like opportunities to travel. And then all of a sudden someone in Tokyo was like, can you come to a design festival? And then someone, you know, in Amsterdam was like, can you come over here and do this thing here? And it just became a nonstop kind of thing. So
nice.
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, obviously there's battles, you know, we had the Levitz battles here in the 80s, you know, stuff like powwow, right?
Yeah.
Were you even aware of that kind of stuff at the time? Like, were you pulling inspiration from those guys, or were you just kind of in your own world and didn't even know about it?
Not really LA culture or history. I mean, I knew about American graffiti history a little bit, you know, from watching certain DVDs, right? So Star Wars, etc. And I knew OG Slick had battled one time when he was a young kid, who's now a friend and sequels artist. I knew bits, but I was kind of, again, building this plane as we were trying to fly.
Sure.
But obviously, yeah, it was heavily influenced from graffiti culture and street art. Mm-hmm. Which street art wasn't even really a thing then. It didn't really have a name at the time. But yeah, bits and bobs. And then I found out there was a thing called, there was like another art battle in New York that kind of started around the same time as us. Mm-hmm. So then we realized that there was competition in the space, and that was good. You know, it was like, okay, cool. That kind of like gets you going again. Sure. So we, we were trying to make up our own rule set, which I think we did pretty well.
Yeah.
And it was very soccer inspired again, because that's me and Jimmy's big passion. It was 90 minutes on the clock. That's a soccer game. Mm-hmm. One, you know, team versus team, or one versus one. There's like a left and a right, two, you know, and then crowd cheer / two guest judges, 3-point system. It was very basic, but it was different from your, you know, usual kind of graffiti battle. We tried to just carve out our own rule set.
Yeah.
So
was there some early mistakes that you made that you thought, let's not do that again?
Add color was one thing. I tried color for a rum sponsored event once upon a time. Uh-huh. They were like, you need to use a certain red. We took a check, you know, and kind of at the time it was good money, but the color just didn't work in the world of the black and white vibes that we were building. Again, that was kind of, there's lots of graffiti battle, mural events, festivals in full color. Let's just do this thing in black and white. Mm-hmm. So color was, for me back then, a mistake, but an experiment.
You know? So what do you think that's, like, creating that limitation of black and white, what does that do?
Originally, it helped differentiate us from everything else, and it kind of helped build a brand. Like, I suppose Supreme, you got the red and white, and you just know, like, you see that colorway. Weirdly, it's, I don't know, it's something in the head, right? It just kind of clicks, and certain brands come to mind. So anybody that looked at black and white murals or art thought Seekables, even though not everything that was black and white was ours, but it kind of just helped us own a lane. We've actually embraced color now, but that's a whole nother story. But like, now that we've gone full digital battles, Jimmy twisted my wrist and said, let's bring color in, and let's take color onto Instagram. And literally last month we added color in, and I kind of protected the OG battle and said, this is untouched. This stays black and white. This is the heritage. But I'm all for the future of 3D, 2D artists in our world should use color. And we kind of found a compromise, and now I'm fully behind it. But I was, at the time I was kind of like allergic to the color thing. But still love the black and white, simple, you know, kind of effect. I think it stands out. You come to a battle, you see it on stage, those white lights on a black and white wall, 50 foot, and you got hundreds of people standing in front of that, just the way it pops. Once you add color into those, it kind of, for me, it gets a little bit scrappy, a little bit messy. So visually, it just, there's a summit there that just pops.
Sure.
So
I love that. I mean, one of the things I love about the story is you're figuring it out as you go, like you said, and you're learning to run a business and lead people and all that stuff at once. And now you got, you know, like I said, you know, Jimmy says, let's do color. And then ultimately it's down to you to decide what fits and what doesn't.
Yeah. And that's kind of the growth. And, you know, organically, as you build a business that wasn't really meant to be a business, that was originally a lifestyle and a way of traveling the world. And there's kind of the we've kind of built it back to front. Some people say is like, you know, you guys built a scene and a culture and an event before you actually made money. And that was by design. You know, it was like, it was a passion project.
Sure.
But now we're like, okay, we're big enough and we have the opportunity to call Nike or, you know, speak to the MLS or whoever and pitch an event and, you know, pay artists very well. And we're proud to like always push, you know, for biggest, you know, biggest budgets and, mm-hmm. you know, biggest kind of artist fees and DJs. And we're always trying to scale. And well, that's taking time and, mm-hmm. and energy. But, we're still weirdly like this bootstrap kind of startup, you know, like you saw the studio is there's, sure. there's a handful of us here. There's two guys in Chicago and then a bunch of virtual kind of support, but, it's still very scrappy. I'm founder, but, we've got some structure now, you know, mm-hmm. we have these like weekly, the daily, weekly and monthly calls where there's real decisions made and all that's quite new to me.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that I'm still learning as a founder, CEO, is mm-hmm. kind of managing your scaling team. You know, that's a whole new thing, right?
So how do you balance those things, right? How do you learn and adopt some of that stuff that lets you scale the business, but also preserve the culture side and what's special about, you know, you don't want to just become
yeah.
some shitty business that, you know, gets a bunch of funding and blows through it. And
Yeah. That is the life I've like led for 16 years, like yeah. from the smallest first job to the jobs and the opportunities we have now to the investors that call and say, hey, can we put some money in and have some equity or whatever it is. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like I always look at myself and Jimmy's definitely by my side on this. We have a very strong protective approach on the brand and the scene and the artists. And Jimmy is an artist and started mm-hmm. as a sequels artist. So mm-hmm. he's been on both sides, but it's like, we want to protect that original DNA, but we also need to embrace how do you appeal to the masses and not be so niche and yeah. you know, how do the kids of tomorrow like get into what you do? And it's not just graffiti anymore. It's fine artists versus a graffiti artist and digital, et cetera. So we're always evolving and we're having to like, you know, have those conversations. But yeah, as brands and the money gets bigger and all that lot, that's just a regular thing that we've had to like check and mm-hmm. check ourselves as we go. It's like certain brand wants to sponsor this. Is it right? First of all, is the brand right? Does it fit with our mission? You know,
yeah.
or do we think that this brand is kind of morally, you know, a brand that we wouldn't want to align with, or they've made moves that don't make sense, that mm-hmm. you know, certain brands without naming, you know, ripped off artists by stealing murals and putting them in advertisements.
Sure.
Do you want to align with that kind of brand, you know, where certain, you know, the Futuras and certain artists of the world have had to then take to court to get paid, you know? Yeah. That's like, that's they're kind of the things that we're always aware of and always thinking about. So yeah, so it's a delicate dance. And I remember at the start when graffiti or street art and graffiti was kind of very young and brands were coming into the space for the first time, everybody, not everybody, but there was a crowd of people that were like, are you selling out? You know, mm-hmm. by taking a Reebok check to then go to Barcelona. It's like, well, not mm-hmm. really in my eyes, because the way we justify it is that they gave us a blank canvas. They promoted the hell out of our brand. Reebok is an awesome shoe brand that unfortunately isn't as big as it should be now. But, you know, loved the product, loved the story. It's British. It felt right at the time. And they mm-hmm. just gave us this canvas to create. And there was very little kind of, there was a very loose creative brief. And those are the kinds of brands that we want to align with, is, you know, they let us do our thing
yeah.
rather than tell us what to do. And, you know, we're just painting adverts. That's not what we want to do.
Sure, of course. So. Are there times when you've gotten that wrong? You've been overprotective or underprotective and had to...
Yeah, I think so. Definitely you make certain moves that you maybe think you could have gone a different way. I think I'm trying to rack my brains. It's hard to think of one
okay.
big mistake,
good.
Which is hard, but I know there is one. I'm just trying to think. you know, we did a Chevy road trip tour for South by Southwest.
Mm-hmm. I remember when they were doing that.
Yeah, it was like a long time ago, seven, 8 years ago. But there was parts of that were awesome. Driving from Detroit to Austin and recording just all these mad moments and having a lot of fun on camera. But the battles were restrictive from what I remember. There was a lot of like do's and don'ts. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the first project where we'd like signed up to something that paid us again a record amount of money. So we were like, okay, this is cool. And we just jumped in with maybe not asking all the right questions. Whereas now we're a bit maturer. Like we've kind of like, we know what to ask and how to navigate and where to stay strong and say Seagulls is best in this format. And this is how we operate with partnerships and collaborations. So that was probably one that was huge at the time. And there was lots of good parts, but then there were some bits that were like, ooh, yeah, we kind of maybe shouldn't have signed up to that part, you know.
Fair enough.
So it felt very Chevy on stage. You know? Yeah. We kind of got drowned out a little bit.
Right.
So, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to name check brands, but there you go.
Okay. We're not sponsored by Chevy. We're sponsored by Ford. So yeah, there you go. You can talk all the Chevy. you know, I think it's interesting the issue, the concept of selling out, right? And I think it's changed very much over the years. I think from where I sit, that doesn't come up nearly as much as it used to.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, if that's, sure, there's a bunch of reasons.
It's changed a lot, you know, like Kors collaborating with Nike, you know, again, great stuff, like the Jordan shoe or the North Face collection that you just done. Is it North Face? But then some people might question that and say, well, North Face were one of those brands that just ripped off Futura. And then there's that argument. And again, everyone's got to make their own decisions.
Yep.
The collection looked awesome. I don't know North Face as a brand, but I, you know, the product's great. But the thing they did against Futura was pretty blatant, you know.
For sure.
But yeah, they got called out and maybe they apologized. I'm not sure how that went. But I think brands in this space is definitely widely accepted now from most artists or all artists that I work with, you know, including like the OG Slicks and those like hardcore kind of graffiti guys. Like everybody is looking for a good opportunity with a brand now, whereas 10 years ago it was kind of a weird place to be. Some artists just didn't want to go in that world because they felt like they were crossing a line, but I feel like all that's just disappeared now. And there's infinite, you know, opportunity if you, you know, choose the right collabs.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it seems like now there's a new minefield, right?
In
whether it's cancel culture or, you know, corporate responsibility, like all those.
Yeah.
Maybe the stuff we used to care about, we don't care about. And now there's a whole new set of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's like there's a, you know, we're trying to do good is part of our brand, like giving back to trying to work with kids and inspiring kids. You know, we work with a lot of good charities and stuff, but again, that influences maybe the brands that you want to align with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like certain brands that have good foundations. So we have like a little checklist now of a perfect kind of collab, and we try and stick as closely to that as we can.
Nice.
Sometimes you have to compromise on areas like creatively, and you know, you kind of have to find a balance, but I think again, that's just part of that kind of new world, like, you know, negotiating and just being strong, you know, in the space that you're in.
Yeah.
So it's time to reboot your credit card with Apple Card. Apple Card gives you up to 3% unlimited daily cash back. It's real cash you can spend right away. No need to wait and wait for rewards. Apply now in the Wallet app on iPhone to see your credit limit offer with no impact to your credit score. Subject to credit approval, daily cash is available via an Apple Cash Card or as a statement credit. See Apple Card Customer Agreement for terms and conditions. Apple Cash Card is issued by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Accepting an Apple Card after your application is approved will result in a hard inquiry, which may impact your credit score.
What's it? So you've got this community that you've built that, you know, follows and ideally is engaged, and obviously they have ideas and reactions to what you do. So how do you process, you know, taking in feedback and engaging with your community, and then still making decisions that maybe not everybody's going to love?
Yeah, that's a good question. Back in the day, it would be very tight. It was a tight circle of 50 artists, you know, telling us their dreams and things that they wanted to do and the places they wanted to go to. So we were building European tours and things off the back of a small squad of London artists mainly, and then they kind of, you know, blended into Europe. But these days, where it's like 1,000, 2,000 artists that have connected and worked with us over the years, I feel like we could do a better job. This is one of the areas that I'm always talking to the lads about, how we can step up communication, transparency. And now we're this, like, even though we're still a team of five, we've got a million things on our plate. How do we keep the flow between artists, sequels, artists, sequels? Don't have all the answers yet, but it's a thing that me and Max, we're normally the guys on the front line talking to the artists about certain projects or battles. So there's definitely a clean, transparent chat about creativity and the event we're building. That still happens. But I'm trying to work out a way of talking to the larger groups as we kind of grow and kind of evolve into different spaces. And obviously there's all the Discords, and we're not on that yet, but that's something that we're looking at. Just watching other brands and collectives operate in places like that. Twitter's pretty new to us, to be honest, but obviously there's a huge community there. So we're just trying to get a little bit better at opening up certain spaces in the future. So I think that you'll see that soon. Love, this is a whole rabbit hole conversation, probably hours long, but like the DAOs. I don't know if you've seen or read much about DAOs, but the whole crypto like DAO thing and the structure of that in my head sounds dreamlike, but then I'm starting to hear some bad stories about certain DAOs. But I do like the idea of community has a stake and then votes and then it's snapshotted and certain things happen because that's where community voted. So I'm trying to read more into that, talking to a lot of Web3 crypto folks that build DAOs and things, and probably going to be somewhere, you know, along the lines we'll be inspired or test that out. Not sure if we'll be a full DAO, but like I think there's business models and collectives I see out there that are doing a good job of kind of being the various like hybrid models that, that allow all of their creative members to feel like they've got a voice. So yeah, just always exploring, always trying to learn. But yes, yeah, the short answer is it's tough, but I think we do a decent job, you know, over the years. As a small unit, we've kind of, as we've traveled globally, I think we've always tried our hardest to make sure the artists are diverse, the artists have a voice. You know, we've always been aware of certain, you know, things in the scene and trying to, you know, just do right to the artist. Like we call it the silo mentality, which is support your local artist. And that's kind of every deck or thought we have is kind of built and connected back to silo. If it doesn't make sense to our silo DNA, then we have to kind of double question it and maybe throw it out. So there's
interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of internal checks.
So how does that work? You know, we think of this global culture, but, you know, my experience, you know, there's big differences from one part of the world to the other. And, and you know, as you're saying, coming from London, you have a different perspective on graffiti and street art than somebody coming from LA or New York. And then when you go around the world. So how do you think about that balance, right? Between really reflecting the local culture, you're hosting battles all over the world. Yeah. I had no idea that you guys were as global as you are.
Yeah, previously, right? The last 2 years, very, very LA shut down. Right. But
I think before that, it was like 50 plus countries, right?
Yeah.
So how do you do that, go into a market and kind of respect and reflect the local culture while at the same time bringing the global perspective?
Yeah, I mean, that we've been lucky enough to get to all those countries over the years. And I think the first thing is make sure you're working with local artists. Don't just fly a crew of, you know, Americans or Brits into Japan and expect to fill a room. So we've always, our concept has always been flexible enough to allow us to use a local host that's going to speak the local language or speak English and Japanese or English and Spanish or wherever we are. And then also, yeah, work with local DJs. So it's always, again, support your local artists. It's always the silo thing first. And then if we've got the opportunity and the budget, let's then send in some of the big guns that we feel add value. You know, like if it's a Greg Mike, you know, from Atlanta, you know, who's now a pretty big deal, flying into England for the first time, and we can build a story around that, then let's do it, you know. So, but it's always build local first and then add those international kind of guests second. But I think if you've got the local part right, then it's going to be great. You know, it's you're going to fill a room and you're going to put on a good show. But yeah, try and pepper a little bit, you know, find that balance. So maybe it's like 60-40, 70-30 in kind of local, you know, talent favor.
Yeah,
that's helped. That's kind of got us to where we are today. And I've seen very few failures. I've been to most of those shows across most of those countries. And again, just outside of the battle, learning about the culture. And that's the bit that no one sees through Instagram or through our videos, is the experience that we have. That again, now that I'm getting older, I'm reflecting on past 16 years, it's like very lucky to have been toured, you know, all these cities by those local artists to then point out the best restaurants and the best underground speakeasy and the coolest like hangs and and just the culture in general, just like a temperature check. Like, you don't get that as a tourist, but we've always had this like kind of secret pass, because you connect with those right folks that, you know, open the city up to you because they trust you, right? So
that's
a hard thing to do for you can't maybe that can't just be copied in a way, but I think if you build that way with that intention, then I think that's what's served us well.
Yeah, that makes sense. I love that, and I think, you know, my own experience, you know, when we've created programs, you know, that go into different markets, and it's all about connecting the, you know, the locals maybe with their heroes that they never get to meet, or
definitely,
or forging new, you know, the up and coming guys in two different markets that, you know, end up collaborating or stuff like that.
That's the magic as well. Yeah. And that's what we saw in our very low budget version of our first tour. When we drove around Europe, it was, we were bringing a couple of Brits along for the ride, but we were working. It was like, it's kind of like England versus Holland, Amsterdam, England versus Germany. And we kind of created these like country battles, but it was the connectivity of sending artists to different countries for the first time that I started to hear stories from artists that had never really traveled before, that all of a sudden were on a flight to go do a Secret Walls, and they were like, oh, I hung out with this like local crew and I made friends for life and I learned this and this inspired me. And then collaborations and projects are born out of that, right? And Secret Walls plays a tiny part in connecting those dots. But I think we realized quite quickly that the event outside of the competition, it was that some of the press had noticed it pretty quickly. It was a safe kind of creative, you know, it wasn't too cool for school. It was kind of a place where you had a mixed crowd that people could come, be inspired, but also meet other like-minded folks. And that was something, again, we didn't build by design, but it kind of somehow became a thing. And that's something that we're trying to continue to like remember and bottle up as we build, is is how do you create those you know, same moments, those kinds of spaces. And yeah, that was the value that we were giving to artists. And you're right, like, it's when you fly certain artists in that are their heroes. We did that in Jakarta, and a lot of the Jakarta guys, super talented, but don't have the means to travel. They haven't got the dollars, but skill-wise, they're as good as any of the guys here in America. But we flew some big guns in, and we all got drunk together and battled together, and it was just like a whole life-changing kind of moment. And,
that's cool.
And now it's opened up channels, and we're trying to bring them over here, and, you know, again, it's just cool to see. So that kind of exchange is dope.
So one of the things I've always loved about graffiti is the competitive nature of it, right? That you know, I've always said, like, I don't know if Monet and Manet were like battling it out, right? At least not in the direct sense of, you know, of what you do. And, you know, we've heard stories from some of the OGs of, like, you know, guys getting thrown off the roofs, and graffiti was tied up with gangs, and the competition was not friendly.
Yeah.
Right. Do you run into that at all? Like, is there, you know, I think obviously you're trying to keep it competitive.
Yeah.
And people take it really seriously.
There's been some heated moments on stage.
Sure.
Not many, but I there's been some chairs thrown, you know, artists mm-hmm. versus artists, and
yeah.
certain graffiti crew pissed because certain other artists lost. And,
yeah.
you know, we've had some crazy times, but that, I look at that as like, you know, it adds to the entertainment, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
We look at like UFC and boxing and wrestling as ways to like, you know, can you know inspire ourselves to create a better show. And when there's an emotion like that in the room, obviously not dangerous, like that's not something that we endorse, but if it's a little bar scrap or mm-hmm. a chair flying, that's only adds to the story.
Sure.
You know, we've seen artists like line someone else out on the other side, which mm-hmm. isn't very sportsmanlike, but at the time it was a world first for
it's
us.
It's relevant to the culture.
Yeah, and sure. he had a graffiti beef with certain other artists and yeah. had to make a certain message, and I was pissed at the time. I was like, wow, okay, you just destroyed guy's work. But I look back on it, and when I see him in the pub, you kind of laugh about it. And, you know, so yeah, it kind of comes into it, but it's never been that serious or
sure.
dangerous. But there are some graffiti artists that are in and out of trouble
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I'm aware of certain stories. But yeah, it doesn't really come into the arena so much of Secret Walls. So yeah, I don't know. I hear stories from like Slick and the boys here. LA seems crazy back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just hear now as like the old days. You know, right. It's like guns and bullets flying and gangs, yep. and that doesn't really happen in London.
Sure,
it was like I think knife crime's a thing, but
yeah.
guns don't really exist so much in England. And
yeah, gang, we love our guns out here.
Yeah, yeah. Gang violence is similar to like Japan in England. It's like it's very hidden.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of you don't really see it.
Sure.
It's but out here from some of the stories I was told, and you know, all the way back to the riots, there was like some insane times, you know.
Definitely.
So
and so, you know, how do you think about you're working, you know, at the same time with huge brands
mm.
that care a lot about brand safety,
yeah,
about, you know, the kind of your point, you've got these conditions that you want your partners to meet, they have as well, right? So,
yeah.
But you've been really successful at taking a kind of illegal, subversive art form and bringing it to some of the biggest brands in the world.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
That's been the thing I've had to learn from scratch, was translate. In the early days, it was harder because you were trying to sell this culture and these artists to a brand and say, this is safe and
sure.
it's going to be family friendly and we can behave ourselves and, you know, kind of have to beg a little bit more, like give us a chance. You know, now it's kind of easier because we've got a million case studies to point at and go, this is what we did over here. And we know the kinds of artists that fit that brief. And, you know, it just comes second nature. It's like, okay, you gave me this creative brief, it's soccer inspired. There's certain artists that love soccer and draw certain things that I'll go straight to. But Slick's maybe always, I used his name already a bunch of times, but Slick and MLS we did last year.
Mm-hmm.
Again, certain brands might be scared of an artist like Slick and past history or just the connection between certain crews.
Mm-hmm.
But MLS are pretty safe as well and are a solid like supporter and client of ours. And it's a conversation and certain questions might come up, like, you know, and there might be a do's and don'ts list of this is a mm-hmm. family-friendly crowd, so can we stick to this and don't do that, and no drawing of guns and knives and drugs. And so right. that stuff comes up, and
yeah.
I just have to, I'm the guy that's translating between Slick and the brand. And that was actually an easy conversation, and Slick was allowed to do pretty much what he wanted within reason. Built a sculpture, made a LA hand mural in the kind of colorway of that All-Star game. But other than that, MLS respected us as artists and creatives and was like, let Slick be Slick. But just, yeah, let's stick and be inspired by this brief. And I know Slick's super pro. And
sure.
again, it was an easy one. But sometimes, you know, as long as artists tell us what they're comfortable in doing and not doing, I suppose mm-hmm. that's just part of the daily hustle is trying to locate the right artists, explain the brief, get that kind of do's and don'ts list from the brand. Some are more sensitive than others. And then just have those conversations. Sometimes they opt out and say, it's not for me.
Yeah.
It's very rare because I feel like me and Max have kind of got a you know, there's a certain, done it so many times that you just know who's sure. going to be into it.
Yeah.
sometimes the dollars might not be right, or sometimes the creative brief might not be right, you know. But again, we kind of know where certain people net out and what people's feelings are. So
I also think the more you do it, right, the more the community becomes more comfortable.
Yeah.
Right. And they say, okay, well, you know, Slick did it, or, you know, all these other people. So yeah. I guess I can find a space for myself in there as well.
Yeah. And every, you know, artists know that what we are as a brand, and I think they expect a certain level of creativity and curation. So usually there's very few projects where, again, I feel it was a failure or we sold out, because I don't think we've done anything that's like a complete flop. But I think there's times where it could have been better.
Sure.
But yeah, you learn from that, and kind of, I think artists, again, having the artist support and trust is key for a brand like us. If we don't have that, then we're not in business, you know. Like, so it's built on artist trust and communication, which is kind of why I'm obsessed with this like whole new Web3 world of how do we all communicate and benefit, and you know, there's all the other business monetary things with blockchain and all this new stuff that allows you to disrupt the old school art scene, and maybe kind of, you know, just, I don't want to say destroy, but like it turns the gallery model of gallery gets lion's share,
right.
artist gets whatever left. Everything changes now, and this is the kind of new world that really excites me. It's like sequels can play a really big part in that, because we've been fighting that fight for a long time. But within, there were certain things we could and couldn't do before this kind of Web3 blockchain world. Now there's like what we do with the art, you know, and all these other opportunities that present themselves. So I think, it's exciting, man.
Yeah, I mean, talk about that a little bit more. So you're 16 years in, and, you know, I know as an entrepreneur, it's a grind, and it's, you know, I think keeping your own head in the game is sometimes the challenge. And you go to managing people and investors and brands and, you know, all that stuff. So how do you, and now you're exploring all this technology side, right? So how do you kind of monitor yourself and stay excited and engaged? And
I also had a kid, like he's 2.5. So he was born a month before the pandemic started. Wow. So I became a new parent as well, which was a challenge, you know?
Yeah, I bet.
Still figuring that out.
Of course. So
I don't have as much time as I like.
Yeah.
I don't go out as much as I used to. Social life is not the same, but no regrets, and love being a dad. Basically having the right team around you to go to the shows that now I can't go to, and making sure that we're finger on the pulse, you know, in this LA scene and, you know, as far as London and back, and just trying to stay in tune. Wearing a lot of hats is just something that I've had to learn to deal with. It's not perfect. Kind of being the CEO, the founder, all of a sudden you're physically producing a battle, because we're a small team, and I enjoy it. I like being on the front line. So we did 2 battles last week, and I'm out there on stage, you know, with the producer, just supporting. I just like being near the artist, making sure they're happy, they got a beer in their hand, pens juiced up, everything's ready to go. It's just an obsessive thing in my head that it's where we started, like painting the white walls, you know, ready for the battle. It's just all hard to pull back from.
Yeah,
but I'm learning how to maybe step back a little bit, and you got to trust your team a little bit more. And as you hire new people, you got to delegate a little bit more. That's all part of my new learning curve. Is as I get older and as the business grows, and we're about to add another 10 people over the next 6 to 12 months. So we're already actively identifying and interviewing, and it's a whole thing. It's all new to me. So I've hired a CEO, a good friend, Kevin, who's based at Chicago. He comes from an agency background. So he's run offices of like 50 plus and built businesses that are like turning over $20-30 million a year or whatever. And he's come into this like weird little scrappy sequels job. And I've kind of, you know, friends for a long time. He brought a lot of cool brands and opportunities to us. And I'm kind of leaning on people like that, because I know that he has, you know, those kinds of people have the experience that, that I lack.
Yeah.
And you just have to recognize that as the founder, and as, you know, just where your weaknesses are, and, you know, try and fill the gaps.
I mean, that's big. I think for most guys in your chair, that's, you know, the letting go is the hardest
part. It's tough, It's tough, because I sometimes emotionally argue about, you know, not argue, but creatively argue about certain parts to the show that need to stay true to the original. And then, you know, I'm getting better at just allowing the dialogue to flow and end up at a place where everyone's happy.
Yeah.
Because Kev now looks at it from business side of things, because he's CEO and that's what he's there to do, is to like bring the next hire in and make sure we're being efficient. And then I'm there as founder with a lot of passion, mainly for the arts, less so for the dollars. And I love the fact that he's now focused on the money, really, and I can get back into culture. And that's the sweet spot. I think that's important. But yeah, still even with him, you know, we're still always, you always feel short, like you need more people and
of course,
kind of going from an investor chat.
Away.
Yeah. Like me and Kevin talking about last week, it's in one day last week, we had an investor pitch where we kind of don't really know if we even need investment, but we kind of just have the calls because we like to just explore. Sure. So it's like we were in this weird room talking about investment. Then we jumped into a client call talking about the coolest battle that we've got this year, hopefully. Then you kind of take the hat off and you're calling an artist and just catching up. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're being a dad and, you know, I work from home a lot. So kind of go into that mode.
Yeah, nice.
And then you go back into chasing an invoice and just stressing about a certain like set of tasks that might not have been done and, you know, production mode. So I was saying to Kev, like, we're still splitting ourselves in quite a few areas and it's stressful, but it's also no regrets. It's like, I wouldn't want to be doing a 9-to-5 job. I'm super happy that some days are harder than others and every week's kind of different to me. It's like, you know, we're not doing it's not an office job, you know?
Yeah, so, for sure.
So I'm super, again, I try and, as you get older, you kind of get soft and I try and reflect a little bit more, just appreciate the moment. Whereas before in the 20s, 30s, kind of sprinting at a million miles an hour and maybe didn't appreciate all those like global chapters.
Yeah.
So I just try and slow down a little bit more now and just enjoy that.
Yeah, that's big.
Minute.
By the way, you know, raising a kid in this culture is super fun.
Yeah.
I was taking my son to B-boy battles with this guy.
Yeah.
When he was 2, 3, 4, 5 years old and took him, I bought him his first piece of art at a Risky show.
Oh, wow.
He was 7. I let him pick it out and he got that on his wall. And
it's like life changing stuff as well.
For sure.
As young as 7 to like go. I mean, I wish I was able to be in those like spaces that young.
Yeah, of course.
I'm kind of excited as my little guy grows, you know, getting him into soccer and the arts and kind of, he's already been immersed with murals and he's already pointing things out and you can see his brain like working in weird fun ways. And
absolutely.
Yeah, no, excited.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate it from a whole different perspective.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm really excited to kind of show him our little world that we've built and see what comes out of it and see what he chooses to do.
Love
it. It's going to be cool.
Love it. Well, let me do a quick lightning round before we let you get back to work. Okay, which favorite city to travel to?
Historically, Tokyo. Been there 10 plus times and was obsessed by it.
Love it.
And want to get back. So Tokyo, I'll stick to that.
I love it. Who's your favorite DJ?
Weirdly, no one probably knows who it is, but DJ Yoda comes to mind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like an old funny remix copy and paste
guy. Cut and paste.
Yeah, cut and paste was, I don't really listen to his work and music very much anymore, but just a crazy fun.
Yeah, I remember
DJ Shadow, other than that, you know. So yeah, it's that kind of vibe.
Nice. What's the last great book you read or listened to?
The wife says I don't read books very well. I buy books, I don't read them.
Yeah.
I got a mounting of books that I kind of think I'm going to read and I never read. But Tipping Point was one that I actually finished.
Cool.
So I'll probably stick to that. That was in the early days of
that's
of
a good one.
Yeah.
What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
Probably Warriors, because I was obsessed by that for a while. Probably Warriors, yeah.
It's a great movie.
And Battle Royale, do you remember that one?
No.
Japanese.
Oh, no, I don't know.
A lot of American spin-offs, maybe.
Okay.
But it was kind of, I think they made a second one that flopped, but definitely check that out. It's quite gory, but it's kind of like a bunch of like outcast kids, similar to, What was the Korean Netflix thing that was massive last year?
Squid Game.
Squid Game. Yeah. Kind of Squid Game's copied Battle Royale. Royale is like 20 years old.
Oh, wow.
I feel like everyone's copied it in a way. But yeah, the Japanese kids got sent to an island and then they had to survive. And, you know, there was one winner, you know, and they all got given scrappy weapons and
nice.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. But.
Did you see Rebel Kings?
Rebel Kings.
Rebel Kings.
No.
You have to Rebel watch it. Kings. It's the documentary.
Oh, hang on.
Basically, that Warriors is based on.
Yeah. No, I met the director.
Did you?
I forget his name, but randomly I met him at a party, and he told me he was pitching and raising money for that. And I know, really? I know, I've never seen it.
It's great.
But yeah, no.
Yeah. It's like it's the true story behind the Warriors.
Okay. All right. Amazing. I have to check that out.
Who's somebody that you've learned a lot from that you've never met?
Never met. Geez, big question. I used to say like Branson, but I don't resonate really with his latest moves. Sure. You know, I used to like his entrepreneurial kind of vibes back in the day when he was like Virgin Music and Virgin Atlantic.
Seems like he kind of lost his way.
Yeah, it feels like it.
We should all be so lucky to have that luxury.
Yeah, you know, he was like that guy jumped in a hot air balloon and just put himself on the front line and started Virgin Atlantic with not a lot of money and kind of just hustled. But now it's different times. But yeah, Branson, I was someone that I always thought would be a cool conversation. But in real life, if I'm allowed to answer, someone that I was looking up to, but then got a chance to meet and work for, was Mark Echo.
Sure.
You know, original graffiti streetwear guy. He gave us the first American show, and as someone that I kind of really want to reconnect with, because he when we were in the early days of Secret Walls, that first show in New York, did this battle in his like basketball office court thing, and he was making loads of money from Echo clothing and just released that graffiti game, and he was like, you know, on top of the world. And then I think a few years later went bankrupt, but he was good enough to like give us 30 minutes of just young kids trying to hustle and make it in America. And he was just giving us pointers. And kind of that really stuck. I think Echo was a big influence in where we are today.
What about, since, you know, we have a lot of grad fans listen to the show, who are some young guys that we should have our eyes on?
Yeah, young artists, Nina Paluma, awesome LA based artist. She just kind of character illustrations, a bit of everything, VR, physical illustration, you know, like all artists, that's super hybrid. Gabe Gault, his dad's like a Super Bowl winner, but he's this like amazing portrait artist that's killing it. I think he just did NFL draft, VR murals in the metaverse. Who else? Dragon 76, Japanese artist based out of New York.
Okay.
He's got a studio in the World Trade Center.
Nice.
Super humble, insane, doing a lot of stuff like Kevin Durant and things. But super humble. Those are the three that come to mind. But there's so many.
Of course. Last one, if I worked for Secret Walls, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Probably Silas, put it like an artist, say it like 20 times a day. But... I'll probably stick with that. I'll probably say it too much, but it's ingrained in the brain. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Love it. Man, thanks for doing this.
Cool, man.
So much fun.
Thanks. Yeah, I forgot to wear my nice sneakers. I totally forgot there was a camera. So,
you're all good. You're representing Reebok.
They're comfortable, you know.
Classics are the best.
I need to replace these. I'd literally wear them on all productions, but.
There's nothing wrong with classics.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, right on, man.
Cool. Thank you.
Yo, that was Terry Guy on Rebel Radio. Make sure you check out Secret Walls online. Go to a show. Buy some stuff. I don't know. New support. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.